you're listening to the Pitch Vision My Coach Cricket Show, and you can find us at pitchvision.com. My name's David Hinchliffe in the UK.
And I'm Kevin Sanfaz from Australia. Hope you've all had a good week so far, because I know I have. We have a bye coming up this week, so there's no game this week. But last week, we had the second half of our fifth game. Mm-hmm. And as some of you might recall, they got 220. The other team got 220 last game. I mean, we got 220, actually. And we had to try and defend that. And it was funny, actually, because it was the first time I got a bowl since the first game last week. And, yeah. And the captain brought me on just when we were getting hammered. So I figured he thought, I can't possibly go any more wrong. So brought me in, and I had the worst start. I mean, I haven't bowled in about 4 weeks in a proper game, and it was just everything was coming out wrong. As I was into my spell, I sort of eased in and got a wicket, which I was happy about.
Excellent.
Sort of set him up and everything. But yeah, it sort of felt good to have a ball after a while.
So just remind us what grade you're playing and where you are in Australia.
I'm in Sydney at the moment, and we have different districts. So I'm playing in the Parramatta district in B7s.
Okay. And you finally got off the mark with a wicket halfway through the season.
Yeah, well, I got 3 wickets in the first game, and my captain just never bowled me after that. So it's pretty strange, but I'm trying to work on a few things during the bye coming up, which I have 2 weeks. I've actually taken up boxing in the gym. Okay. If you might recall, they're like, last cricket show, I was talking about arm speed, and I was trying to improve that.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was reading a few articles, and I heard Brett Lee started boxing in that India tour to just quicken up his arm speed a bit. So I started trying it out, and I do feel a lot fitter, stronger, and quicker just from a few sort of sessions.
Excellent news. So there you go. There's another thing to add to the arsenal of weapons to use when you're trying to get your arm speed up.
Yeah, that's right.
Did you find the advice of being a bit more like a catapult, you know, having your chest, driving your chest out, do you find that made any difference?
Yeah, that helps a lot, because that, if you don't have the technical side of bowling right, you're not going to have any arm speed at all. So I've tried to perfect all those things in the nets, and it's just a matter of strengthening myself now for the next game.
And that's 2 weeks of strengthening before you're back into it, and back to taking lots of wickets, hopefully.
Yeah, that's right, hopefully. What about you, David? What's new in your town?
Well, as you know, we're not playing much at the moment, it being the winter, so I'm filling my days with my little obsessions, which I get sometimes. And the one that I've been obsessing about this week is vitamin D, which is the sunshine vitamin. It's called that because you get it from the sun. But the trouble is, at this time of the year in the UK or anywhere in the Northern Hemisphere, you are really looking at quite a small amount of sunshine. I mean, it's dark. It's getting dark now about 5:30, 6 o'clock. And it's going to be, but in the depths of winter, when you really get into the depths of it in sort of late December, January, you're talking sort of 4:30, it's getting dark. So.
Wow.
Yeah, and it doesn't get light really until after 7 o'clock in the morning. So there's not a lot of light around at this time of year. So the theory goes that most people living in this part of the world at this time of year are going to be deficient in vitamin D.
Yeah.
Because there isn't enough of it in people's diets, and there isn't enough sunshine to get it, even if you went and stood out in the sun all day. So I've started taking a vitamin D supplement to see if that's making any difference. I mean, the benefits of vitamin D are well documented, but they all come from having a sufficient amount. If you don't have a sufficient amount, then you know, you can damage your bones, you can damage your teeth, all kinds of nasty things can happen. If you don't have that deficiency, then you're on top of your game. So I'm giving it a test. I'm going to see if it makes any difference. So I'll let you know. If it makes any difference, if it cheers me up and gives me a tan, I'll let you know.
How was your eating? Well, I can't call it a diet, can I?
No.
Your last sort of obsession. How was it? How did it go?
Yeah, no, I'm still on that. I'm still doing that. There's still 2 weeks of that left to go. So, yeah, I'm still doing that. So yeah. It's going well, though. You know, I'm still... I've gone down from... Well, I'm not sure exactly how much I weighed when I started, but I think around about 12 and a half stone, somewhere in that region. I'm down to just below 12 stone now, but I don't seem to have lost any strength. I'm still strong in the gym, so yeah, it's going all right, yeah.
Yeah, it's good to hear. We've got a couple of questions this week, David. We should get right into it.
Yeah, great.
If that's okay with you.
Yeah, let's go for it.
Alrighty, question one is from Donovan, and he's a 14-year-old left-arm pace bowler, and he says that he bowls quite good in the nets, but in matches he bowls wide. Do you have any suggestions? Now, David, I can remember that the earlier cricket shows, you had an interview with Ian Pond, and specifically emphasized about running in straight, and he said that if you run in straight, you would bowl straight. What are your views on that?
Absolutely. There's no doubt that Ian is right in that respect. You don't see javelin throwers or long jumpers coming in at an angle. They always run in a straight line.
Yeah.
So they can jump or throw in a straight line. It makes perfect sense. But in Donovan's case, it doesn't sound like it's a technical issue. The reason I say that is because he seems to be doing okay in the net. So if he's doing okay in the nets, he's probably got a reasonable technique. So probably what's happening is when he gets out into the middle, it's a big psychological step forward to him because there's a lot more pressure. So I would say it's probably a more psychological than a technical issue there.
Okay.
So what he needs to do, what Greg Chappell says is, and I'm paraphrasing him a bit here because I can't remember exactly what he says, but what Greg Chappell says is it's like going from kindergarten to university when you go straight from net to playing. You need something in between. You need some kind of practice that bridges the gap between bowling in the net and bowling in a game. You need to go through school. The way he suggests doing that is by having more formal practice games. So you set up a more formal practice session, which we've talked about in previous shows as well, where you have a practice match where you can mess around a little bit with the structure of it to fit in with a number of people you've got at the practice. And you have an actual practice game, which just puts that little bit of extra pressure on. So you get used to that extra pressure in a practice. And the other thing is just to have, you know, a bit of a free mess around type game where you don't really worry about technique or getting things right or doing it in the correct way. You just go out there and have a bit of a bowl against someone who's having a bit of a bat.
Yeah.
And you just completely, you know, just like the kind of games you used to have in the street or down the park and things like that when you were a kid. And the age he is perfect age to be going out and having a bit of a mess around with your mates and not really worrying about it. Doing those two things, the free element of it where you can just put aside all your worries and just play the game, and then the slightly more formal practice session where you have a practice match, then you're bridging the gap then between just bowling in the nets and having a game. So that hopefully will teach him the psychological tricks that he needs in order to go from net to the middle.
Would you also say that the psychological element of him faltering in his line and length can lead to his technical element fraying in his bowling?
Oh, definitely, yeah. I mean, the physical and the mental side of the game are so closely linked that they're almost exactly the same. So if you're standing at the top of your run and you start to worry about, gosh, this guy's going to slap me, about what's happening, what's going to happen, I'm really worried about doing badly, what happens if my technique breaks down, and then you're thinking about all those things as you run in, then the chances are it's one of those self-fulfilling things. If you think that might happen, then it probably will happen.
Yeah.
What he really needs to be doing is learning how to clear his mind when he gets to the top of his run, decide what sort of ball he's going to bowl, then focus on that particular spot on the pitch and then run in and aim to get the ball to land on that particular spot on the pitch. And don't worry about the batsman. Don't worry about the conditions. Don't worry about what's going on in the game. Just do the one thing. Just execute your skill with as clear a mind as possible. And the way you can learn how to do that is through the practice games and the free play games.
So basically he's really trying to get in control of his mind, because that's really the main element to his errors at the moment.
It's hard to say for sure, because the problem is we haven't seen him bowl, so we don't know exactly what's going on there.
Yeah.
But that said, if he can bowl accurately in the nets, then he must be doing something right.
Yeah.
And the only thing that's changed is he's gone from a net to a being out in the middle. Well, it feels very different when you're out standing at the end of your run in a big open field and wondering where the batsman's going to smash you to next. That feels very different from being in the net and knowing that the guy at the other end of the net can't hit you that far because there's a net in the way to block it. So, but essentially, it's exactly, you're doing exactly the same thing. You're running up, you're bowling the ball. That's no change there. So the only difference really is what's going on in your head. And you really need to take what's going on in your head in the nets and bring it to the middle.
Yeah, I guess match practice is sort of an aspect that is ignored a lot, especially in junior levels nowadays, and it should be emphasized upon to sort of increase the confidence of these younger players or players in general, just to help them get a feeling and practice in match conditions.
Without a doubt, I go back to that Greg Chappell thing again, because you know he really does know what he's talking about. You can't go from kindergarten or nursery school, as we call it here, to university in one jump.
Yeah.
You can't do it. But we expect children playing cricket to be able to do it. And if you've only just started playing cricket, like he probably hasn't been playing cricket that long, if that's a problem that he's having. I guess he's probably not played a lot of competitive games. Every game he goes out and plays is a big pressure situation. Maybe in a few years when he's played a lot more games, it's not going to be so much pressure because he's played a lot more games. He's got a more experience in those situations. But until he gets that experience, he's going to be struggling.
All right. Okay, speaking about Greg Chappell, a famous player now turned coach, we have a question from a coach as well, Jamie Griffiths.
Yeah.
And he says, I'm doing a coaching session in college. A part of my assignment is to do a fielding session, and I'm doing underarm throws that I need progress. Have you got any tips for me? What are your thoughts on that, David?
That's another excellent question. I like these type of questions. These are coaching style questions that I really enjoy planning out coaching sessions and things like that. I don't know why. I guess I'm a bit of an obsessive like things like that. When you're talking about underarm throws, that's quite a hard thing to progress because it's a fairly simple skill to teach and learn. Most kids can pick it up within one or two sessions what exactly they need to do in terms of executing that particular skill, because it's a natural thing for kids to be able to run in, pick up a ball underarm one-handed and be able to throw it in the general direction of somebody else.
Yeah.
It does become a bit more difficult when you try and hit a single stump, and that's where it starts to get a bit hard, but the general skill itself can be picked up. Usually most kids will pick it up within one session, or certainly two or three at the outset. Most kids will get a basic idea of how to do it. So how do you progress that? That's quite a difficult one. What I would say is, again, going back to the pressure situation we were talking about before, it's a lot more difficult to execute a skill under pressure than it is when you're just doing it with no pressure. So the progression I'd like to see is gradually increase the pressure on that skill until someone can do it under extreme pressure. So the first session, perhaps I would introduce the skill if they didn't know how to do it. And we're talking about young kids in this particular instance. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't do this step with adults. The first step is introduce the skill, teach them how to do it, and just get them in the feel for actually doing it by getting them into pairs and doing it in pairs. Then the next session, introduce a target. It can be quite a large target if you like, you know, a full two sets of stumps even. You could even go that wide, or you can just have a single stump. That's a single set of stumps. So you're aiming at three stumps to hit.
Yeah.
Then the third session, have it aiming at a target, but also have it in some kind of race situation. So you've got, you separate the group into two or three or four or however many you want, and you do the same thing you were doing the previous week, but then you add a competitive element into it. So you have a race, who can be, which team is going to be first. And that just adds that little bit of pressure of, now you've got to do the skill quickly because other people are racing you. And then the last progression that I would go to is to really put the full pressure on, put it into a very cricket-specific game situation. So in terms of the underarm throw, you're probably looking at, you have two teams. One team is doing the underarm throw, and perhaps you're doing it at one stump now, or maybe a set of stumps which are turned at an angle. So you're aiming at 1.5 stumps or something like that.
Yeah.
And then the other group have a bat and they run between the wickets. So you have a race then between a batsman trying to make their ground and the fielder trying to run in, pick up and hit the stump.
Yeah.
So that is the most cricket specific element then, because that is the most likely thing to happen in a game.
Okay, so in those kind of situations, it's really like progressive workload. So their workload increases as each training session goes by to sort of for improvement.
Yes, exactly. And you're also looking at then over a number of sessions going back to the same skill and just gradually increasing the difficulty of that skill until you get to a point where you can do it in a game situation under the same pressure that you were doing in the practice drill.
Okay.
And you can do that with any skill.
Yeah, I guess, whenever I go to the test matches in Australia, I see the Australian cricket team especially emphasising their fielding before, when they warm up and all that. Do you think international players undertake these kind of match-specific fielding drills?
It's slightly different when you're talking about international players, because they've already gone through all this kind of thing beforehand many, many times in practice sessions and things like that. When you're watching them warming up before a one-day international or a test match, they're really just going through the motions to A, get themselves nice and warm before the play starts, and B, just getting into the groove of doing those skills again. That's all they're doing. They're just re-going over, reminding themselves how it feels to do the pickup, how it feels to throw the ball in it, and all the rest of it. In a warm-up situation, you're not really looking to improve the skill, because it's a bit late.
Yeah.
Just before play, really. You're not looking to improve the skill there. You're just looking to get the skill, remind yourself of the skill that you've already learned. So that's a slightly different situation. Yeah. They will have, if they've got a weakness, if an international player has got a weakness, a fielding weakness, they'll have worked on that time and time again on daily training sessions. Yeah. Probably at the more advanced end of things, compared to, say, when you're introducing a bunch of 11-year-olds to a new skill like an underarm throw, that's going to be completely different. Yeah. It's going to take longer and a greater number of weeks to get to the point where the international players start.
What about for college or university students? Do you think that underarm throwing should be included in the warm-ups?
Oh, without a doubt. I think, especially at the club level or the amateur level.
Yeah.
Way too many underarm throws are missed because A, players aren't switched on to somebody running a quick single, so they're caught on their heels in the first place, and B, even if they do react quickly, the throw under pressure is poor. So they get to the ball, and if they successfully pick it up, which they don't always, but if they successfully pick it up, because of the pressure of the batsman running, the throw is off target. So nobody wins there except the batsman. But if you do a bit of practice that beforehand, even if you only do half a dozen of those, just to sort of get the feel for hitting the top of the stumps with a single stump, then you're going to be a lot more likely to do it in the game. But that's slightly a warm-up. Doing it in a warm-up is slightly different. So we want to be careful about being clear of the difference between doing it in a warm-up, which isn't when you're developing the skill. It's not when you're progressing the skill. It's just, it's just a warm-up. Whereas if you're doing it in training sessions, you actually have an aim of developing the skill in some way or progressing the skill in some way.
All right. This next question coming up is probably, I've experienced it a few times as well. And Rex asks, the clique is, my club has a rather specific issue. Well, he says his club has a rather specific issue. He says that the clique is being formed by the captain and his thirst for improvement. Over the last two seasons, we have won our league and been promoted. The captain this season has started bringing in outside players who he sees will push the club onto the next level. However, the identity of the team is starting to be lost. I am one who has suffered from this, originally opening the bowling of the, in the first, to coming on first change, to not getting a ball, and now having been dropped to the seconds. Not only am I and the others not getting a game in the first, but we don't want to play because there is an uncomfortable atmosphere. What are your thoughts on the situation? I think this is a recurring problem in many clubs, David. I mean, captains, they tend to get complacent and ahead of themselves, and before thinking about enjoyment of the game, they think about winning as the soul. I mean, winning is important, but enjoyment of the game is as important as that, and it's happened in my club as well. I mean, what are your thoughts on situations like these?
I agree with you. Winning is important, but also giving people a game, because we are talking about amateur players who are taking up their afternoons doing something that they want to enjoy.
Yeah.
And they're not, I don't believe those two elements are in conflict with each other. I believe that you can do both. You can give everybody a game and still focus on winning.
Yeah.
There are ways of doing that without getting too bogged down in winning. And also getting too bogged down in giving everybody a game. There are ways of doing both. I think in this particular case, it sounds like there's been some damage caused to the team's spirit with the introduction of new players. So new people have come in, it doesn't feel the same anymore, and it's all gone a little bit pear-shaped.
Yeah.
So that kind of damage takes time to fix. You can't fix that overnight with any simple tricks. It's one of those things that you have to build it back up again over the course of a season or two seasons, something like that. But it can be done with a captain who really has the aim of building team spirit back up again. The reason why it's broken down is because trust has broken down between the captain and the players. And it sounds like there's a couple of factions going on there, where you've got the captain with his new players, and you've got the old players who feel like they're being pushed out, even though they've had success in the past. So I think the captain has a key role here. Individual players can't do this. The captain has a key role in bringing the two sides together, really, and redefining exactly what is happening. A lot of teams talk about roles. If you hear teams talking from the psychological point of view, the professional teams, you hear them talking about defining roles and what role people have in a side and all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And if you get that right, everybody knows exactly what they're doing. And if everybody knows exactly what they're doing, and if everybody knows exactly what everyone else is doing, then it's a lot easier for trust to exist. You might not necessarily agree with the particular role that either you have or somebody else has, but you know what it is. And that's a very important part of it. So the key thing to building trust back up again is to redefine the roles. And it sounds like what's happened is, over time, one set of players' roles has gradually been eroded away with no real discussion about it, while another set of players have come in. So the two groups are clashing with each other. So if I was captain of that side, I would sit down with the players and I would help them redefine everybody's role. So the chap who asked the question, Rex, has said, you know, I feel aggrieved because, you know, I've gone from being an opening bowler in the first team to being a second team bowler. Well, if that's how the captain sees his role now, as just a second team bowler, and maybe someone who comes in when someone else is injured or something like that, then the captain needs to say that to him. okay, he can put it in as nice a way as he can, but he needs to clearly define that role. He say, well, look, I understand you may not agree with this, but this is how it's going to be. However, I still consider you a player in my squad, so don't think that you've been left on the sidelines. I still consider you a player in my squad. I want you to put in the good performances in the second team, because if I need to call on you for the first team, I need you to be putting in the good performances for the second team. So then he knows exactly what his role is.
Yeah.
I would also get together with all the players. All the players sit down with them together and start getting together some sort of shared rules and some shared values on how the team is going to develop over the course of a season. Things that everybody agrees is a good thing to do. Now, that can be different for different teams. One team might say, right, everybody has to wear the club kit, the complete club kit, and there's no exceptions. You have to have the cap, you have to have the jumper, you have to have the shirt, and you can't wear anything else. That could be one thing that could keep the team together. Now, other teams will think that's a completely silly thing, and they wouldn't do that. But the idea is to come up with a set of shared rules that everyone agrees to and everyone can stick to. Like, for example, we agree to share the responsibility for losing games among each other and not blame each other for causing a defeat.
Yeah.
That's another one. And that one links into the roles that people have. So someone may be an opening batsman who's a terrible blocker. That guy might be considered to be a bit old-fashioned by some other players in the team, but the captain considers him to be doing an important role because he's seeing off the new ball, so his middle order can come in and smash the ball around at the end.
Yeah. Okay.
So he needs to make that clear. So he needs to make that clear to not only to the guy who's the blocker, but also the rest of the team. This guy is doing an important job for us, so you middle order guys can go out and dash it around at the end.
Okay.
Another rule you might have is that you reward each other's success. So if someone does something well, then you make a specific point of rewarding each other's success. So there's some examples. You can come up with your own things.
So it really is about clear communication clear communication throughout the team.
Yes. Especially the captain to the other players. Defining those rules is very important.
Okay.
And one thing a captain might want to do is, if he sees factions forming, is to deliberately get players to help each other from different factions. So if you've got a new bowler and you've got an old bowler, and then you know that the new bowler is a very good bowler, but he has a certain weakness, you know, he doesn't know how to bowl a very good slower ball, for example, then the captain can go to the old bowler and say, look, you bowled a really good slower ball. Is there any chance next time we're in the nets, you two can have a chat about how to bowl a good slower ball? And get the factions working together to help each other and to coach each other.
Yeah.
And as long as they understand each other's jobs and what they're trying to do, then that hopefully will bring the individual factions together. But the really important element is that everybody needs to start trusting each other again.
Okay.
Because if everybody trusts everybody else, you can't really have factions forming. You can a little bit, but if the trust is there, everything else falls into place.
Yeah, I think, especially in our team, with the captain bringing in new players as well, similar to Rex's situation, it's sort of created a division where there's two sorts of groups, where there's the old players group and the new players group. How would you suggest bringing those two groups together? Because it's pretty hard for both groups to start trusting each other.
Are you in the new bowlers group? Are you in the new players group, would you say?
No, I'm in the old. Well, we're both from two teams and we've just merged together. So I'd say we're the old players and they're the new players, yeah.
Okay, all right. Well, that's fine. So your group, what is it that you don't trust about the new ones?
I guess that it's the captains. Those are all the captain's mates, and they're the ones who are in the top five, and they're the ones who get the ball. They bowl about 20 overs or 10 overs each game, while the rest of us are sort of, we mop up the tail and Yeah, we don't. Well, we're not trusted by the captain, basically.
All right. Okay. So you feel it's not necessarily the other group as such. It's that
Yeah.
you're not being treated fairly by the captain. He's treating the others preferentially to you. Okay. So
That's right.
okay. Well, in that this is where it boils a big part of it boils down to the captain. The captain has to be seen to be fair, which can be hard to do because different people have different values. Different people understand differently what fairness is, but we all kind of have an instinctive grasp on whether we're being treated unfairly or not. So it's a bit of a juggling act for a captain, a bit of a tricky one to do. He might feel that he's treating everybody fairly.
Yeah.
So he has to be careful about finding out whether people feel like they're being treated unfairly or not. Because
Yeah.
otherwise you don't trust. So what's really happening there is it's not that there's two groups that are not trusting each other. It's that one group isn't trusting the captain in that particular case.
Yeah.
So the captain needs to really help redefine the roles that the players have in the group that feel aggrieved. And
Okay.
if he says to you, look, I'll be honest with you, I don't think you are ready to bowl regularly yet, but I'll do my best to give you a bowl when I can, then at least you know the situation. Whereas at the moment it's unsaid.
Yeah.
So you have a problem there. But if he actually says that to you, then you can say, right, okay, so what do I need to do to prove to you that I can do that? Because I believe I can. So what do I need to do to prove to you that I can do that? And he'll say, well, okay, you need to do A, B, and C. So then you can go, okay, thank you very much. You go away, do A, B, and C. Come back and say, right, I've done A, B, and C. You're going to give me a bit more of a bowl this Saturday.
Yeah.
There's not really.
Okay.
And you can see how it's a two-way communication, and he can do that with every player, and everybody starts trusting the captain. As long as the captain says, "Okay, you've done A, B, and C," then he gives you the ball first change. You then trust the captain then, because he's done what he said. He's told you what you needed to do. You've gone and done it, and then he's done what he said he would do.
Yeah. Okay.
But as long as it goes unsaid, as long as the roles are unclear. Then you've got the problem of not being able to do anything about it, which is really when the trust falls down.
So it's all about trust and communication.
It's all about trust. Everything is about the trust. The communication breeds the trust. So it all
Yeah.
boils down to whether you trust, and it's not necessarily always the captain's fault. And
Yeah.
obviously, I don't know the situation, your situation, but what it sounds like to me is. There's a certain group of players who aren't trusting the captain anymore. They feel aggrieved. They need to get that trust
Yeah.
back by having a more clearly defined role in the side.
Okay. Yeah, those are some very useful thoughts, David. We should probably be getting on to the next question.
Yep.
Dave and Subur have asked, they say, can you guide me with some weight training exercises for a mature player?
It's actually two questions from two separate people. It's just that they were so similar to each other. I thought, well, why not, lump them both together? So it was Sabor who asked the original question. Dave, who's a leg spinner that has taken up the game quite late, he emailed me with a very similar question about what kind of exercises he can do. So
Yeah.
I thought, why not lump them all together?
Okay.
The first thing to say is it doesn't really matter how old you are. There's certain exercises you can do at pretty much any age. It doesn't really make a lot of difference. Obviously, the older you are, the less weight you'll be able to perform those exercises at. But it doesn't mean you shouldn't perform them at all. A lot of people think when you get to 25, there's no point in doing anything else. You might as well just give up, get the middle age spread going, and enjoy the high life.
Yeah.
But actually, the older you get, the more important it gets to be doing resistance-based training and also cardiovascular type training to improve the performance of your heart and your lungs. Because the older you get, the more likely you are to be susceptible to the diseases of aging.
Yeah.
So, to answer Sabor's question, really, just follow a normal weight training program that I'm always talking about, the clear principles of something that is progressive, something that overloads your muscles, something that involves multiple joint compound movements like, you know, squats and deadlifts and things like that.
Yeah.
Something that you can do regularly, and something that improves your strength and your power.
Yeah.
While being cricket specific as possible as you can in the gym. The only thing really with older people is you might need to have a bit of a longer warm up because it takes your muscles that much longer to get going compared to when you're 18 years old and, you know, you can basically just walk into the gym and start lifting weights without doing any kind of warm up at all almost. I wouldn't recommend that, but, you know, a lot of people do. At the gym I go to, I see people walking in, you know, they literally walk in off the street, they do one warm up set of bench press and then they put on, you know, 60 kilos on each side and they're off. You know, and you think, Christ, you know, you're gonna cause yourself some damage there. But if the older you get, the longer it takes to warm up, generally speaking, and that's before playing cricket as well. Especially if you're an opening bowler, you might need to give yourself 20-25 minutes to warm up instead of 5-10 minutes, for example.
Yeah.
And you probably want to do more mobility work because the older you get, the less mobile you get. So in that warm-up, you probably want to be doing a bit of active stretching and dynamic stretching, and so a bit more mobility work and stuff like that.
Okay.
In terms of the cardiovascular side of it, which is a little bit less of what Sabor asked, because he didn't really ask about that, but it's what Dave did. He asked, you know, can I, you know, is there any cricket-specific stuff I can do? Because I get bored running around the streets and, you know, I don't want to sit on a bike in the gym for half an hour just pedaling away.
Yeah.
I wouldn't probably recommend doing that anyway if you're talking about cricket-specific training, because that type of training is not the most specific to cross over to cricket. So what Dave has done, which is a good idea, is he has found a wall and he's got sort of a softball and a cricket bat and he just...
Yep.
Does drives up against the wall for a few minutes. And it really tires him out, gets him going and gets his legs moving. And that's pretty good because it is quite specific. And, you know, it's getting the heart and lungs working, which is the important part of cardiovascular training. It's not going to be a great skill development thing, although it will help with his hand-eye coordination, his balance, which is always a good thing to do. And, of course, Don Bradman famously had the stump and the golf ball, didn't he?
Yeah,
and he would just bounce the golf ball against a water tank, wasn't it? With a stump over and over and over again, and he did all right. So it must be something in that. So maybe a golf ball and the stump is a bit difficult to start with. So maybe start with a one of those soft cricket balls and a normal sized cricket bat. Then maybe go to one of those thin cricket bats you can get. Have you seen those where the edges are cut off?
Yeah, those. I think they call the iron cricket bats or something.
Yes, yeah, something. There's lots
something
of different
like
mates.
Yeah,
and, yeah there's yeah. lots of different types of them. So you can progress to one of those. Maybe get a kid's size ball instead of an adult size ball. And if you get really good, maybe you can go to the stump and the golf ball.
Yeah.
But anything that gets your heart rate up, anything that you enjoy, you know, play five-a-side football, you know, play basketball. If you enjoy going for a run, go for a run. Just do a variety of things, really, that gets your heart and your lungs working, because that's important for preventing things like heart disease and osteoporosis and stuff like that.
Yeah. Would you say that there's a limit mature age men and women can do weight training or any kind of exercise up to?
Generally speaking, or were we talking about cricket?
Cricket specific.
Well, there'll be an age where you're probably getting a bit old to play cricket anymore.
Yeah.
But if you're fit, that could be well into your 60s.
Yeah.
If you're fit enough, then in fact, I know of people who have played in their 60s who are not particularly fit.
Yeah.
But they still enjoy playing, you know, they'll still turn out. So I suppose in cricketing terms, you can weight train right up to the point that you retire. Whatever that age is, whether that age is 35, 40, 45, 50, 55, whatever that age is, you can train right up to the point where you retire. And then you can train after you retire as a way of just keeping healthy. There's no limit to it. And in fact, the research has been done, in terms of health side of it, research has been done where they take, where they've taken people in their 80s who have never done any formal weight training before.
Yeah.
And they put them on a weight training program, obviously a very adapted weight training program. They're not heading into the gym and doing, you know, one rep maxes straight off the bat. They're doing limited stuff, but still stuff that overloads their muscles and still stuff that progresses. And you see within 4 weeks, you see an improvement in muscle strength and an improvement in cardiovascular health.
Yeah.
So even in relatively healthy 80-year-olds, you still see the benefits, the health benefits. So there's no reason why somebody who is still playing cricket couldn't start training. Even if you're in your 40s, it's not too late. If you still think that you can play cricket in your 40s, and if you're talking about club cricket, there's plenty of people who can, then you can make a contribution as a player, then you should be in the gym, because it gets more important the older you get to keep your strength up, because every year your strength declines naturally as you get older, but you can reverse that decline just through strength training. So if you're not training and you think you're a bit old to start, you're not. If people in their 80s can start, you certainly can.
Yeah, so it's never too late. I guess it depends on personal capabilities as well.
Oh yeah, I mean, you have to customize it to your own strength levels wherever you are. Someone who's very, very strong naturally can do more than someone who is very weak naturally, but everybody can do something. Everybody can start somewhere, as long as you, even if you're just take press-ups as an example. Not everyone can do a press-up.
Yeah,
not everyone can do one press-up. That's fine. If you're not strong enough to do one press-up, then start by doing press-ups where you're on your knees instead of on your toes. And if you're not strong enough to do one of those, do them up against the wall. So you're pushing back and forth up against the wall. That's, I mean, at that level, you're talking about probably people who are, you know, getting on a bit and have to start somewhere. But you can go from doing the press up against the wall to doing a box press up, which is where you form a box shape with your body, with the bottom of the box is the ground, and you do a box press up, which is a bit easier than a press up on your knees. You can progress to that, and then you can progress to the knees, and then you can progress to the full press up, then you can progress to your feet elevated, then you can progress to putting on a weight vest. It doesn't take long. You just pick the starting point, which is whatever you can do, and then progress it. So the starting point might be a lot further up. It doesn't matter, as long as you're wherever you start, as long as you're moving forward from that point, then you're going to get the benefits.
Our last question for the day is from our very own Droop, and he asks, "Hi, I've been having some problems with no balls. As my stride has grown longer and I've lengthened my hang time and leap to the wicket, I've been having problems with no balls. I generally always jump from next to the stumps, but now jumping from there causes a no ball. Increasing my run-up didn't help either, because I'm so used to jumping from beside the stumps. Also, I tried assuming the umpire as the wicket and the wicket as the crease, but when I bowled from the stumps, I felt out of control and bowled wides and full tosses. What should I do to stop no balls, as well as retain pace and accuracy?" Whenever I have bowling problems, David, from any changes I've made, I found it best to go back to the basics and sort of start working from there, and then try and change little things, and if they dramatically change my accuracy, I'll try and figure out what part of that change is causing that. What would you recommend for Dhruv?
Yeah, that's a good strategy that you were talking about there. The problem that Dhruv is having is that his legs have got longer. So as his legs have got longer, obviously, you know, his stride has got longer. So let's put the technical issue aside of it. He's increased his hang time, which is, for people who haven't read the Fast Bowler's Bible, which is Ian Ponce's book on fast bowling, hang time is just the jump into the delivery stride. So that's what hang time is. So let's put that to one side for the moment. Rather than having a natural run up, he's running up and then using a marker, which is the umpire or the stumps, to decide when he jumps. Rather than jumping at the same point every time, he's not trusting his run up. He's almost splitting his run up into two, run up, and then bowl. Rather than it being one continuous movement from running up into the bowling action and then through the follow through. So I'm not saying he's stuttering or anything, but in his mind, the run-up is a separate thing from the delivery, from the jump and then the delivery.
Yeah.
So really, the key thing I would say is change your mindset. Don't decide where to jump from. Just decide however many paces it is before you jump. That's when you jump. Doesn't matter what else is going on. Now, that can be hard to do. You can do the old classic trick of marking your run-up out with your eyes closed. That's a good one, if people don't know that one, is you find an empty bit of field, which is, there's no obstructions, you put a marker down, you run up, and when you feel ready, you bowl, and then you put a marker down where you bowled from, and then you know exactly how long you mark that out, and you know exactly how long your run-up is, how it should feel, rather than what you're seeing. So in theory, then, you could run up and bowl with your eyes closed and you wouldn't bowl a no ball.
Yeah.
Because it's exactly the same every time. So that's a good trick to try. Another good psychological trick, which Ian Pont suggests, is don't worry about trying to land on the line, because the line is very thin. It doesn't take much for your foot to go over the line. So don't worry too much about landing on the line. Aim to land in the gap between the bowling crease and the popping crease. The return crease and the popping crease. Aim to just land in that area. It doesn't matter if you land towards the back of it. It's not going to seriously affect your pace. You have to bowl from about a yard behind the umpire for it to seriously affect your pace. So just aim to land in that box, because that box is a much bigger target to land in than that little thin line.
Yep.
So that could be another thing to try as well. Don't worry too much about where you're jumping from. Just worry about where you're landing and aim to land in a big area. Then when you get comfortable doing that, maybe then aim to land towards the front of it so your toe touches the front line.
Okay.
Then, because if your toe's just touching the front line, then you've got a bit more room. You've got a whole foot's worth of room to manoeuvre if you get it slightly wrong. But start by just aiming to land in that box, and it's not going to affect your pace in any way at all if you land in the middle of the box rather than with your foot right up against the line.
Yeah.
So those are the two things I would do. The first one, thinking back about it, the first one I would do definitely, because his stride pattern and his stride length will have changed because he's grown. So definitely do that one again. And do that at regular intervals. The more you grow, the more often you should do that. Maybe even once every 3 months if you're going through a bit of a growth spurt.
You wouldn't say that he's having any psychological or any problems mentally about these no balls? I mean, I know he's been working a lot on his hang time and all that, but would you say that he's been working too hard so that he's trying to concentrate on those and maybe because of that he's bowling no balls?
Well, it's possible. It's certainly possible. If he's trying to improve his hang time, then if he's jumping forward more, then he's going to land further forward, so he's got more chance of bowling a no ball.
Yeah.
But if he likes having the increase in hang time, then he's going to have to work backwards from that and say, because of the hang time and also because I've grown a bit, I'm going to need to remark my run-up. And I'm going to need to think, psychologically, I'm going to need to think, land in the box, not on the line.
So really, he's going to have to concentrate on not trying to get his foot on the line, but between that gap, as you mentioned.
Yeah, if you think of the bowling crease, the return crease, and the popping crease as three edges of a box,
Yep.
with the other edge of the box that you can't see, it's level with the stumps, then just aim to land in that box. And even if you land towards the back of that box, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Because it's not going to affect your pace. But at least you know, right. at least you're confident then of where you're landing. And when you're confident where you're landing, then you can forget about the no ball issue.
Well, hopefully that helps you, Drew. If any of you guys have got any questions, please email us at mycoach@pitchvision.com. It's mycoach@pitchvision.com. Hope you all have a great week. From Sydney, Australia, this is Kevin Sampath signing off.
And this is David Hinchcliffe in the UK.